So, welcome back. Nice to be back again with everybody, all the Vaishnavas and Vaishnavis. I thought maybe we'd do a little chanting when we begin this afternoon. It's always nice to chant Hare Krishna. So, one thing we do when we're chanting, just to be in tune with the purposes of the course, or that we're trying to remain connected to the meanings of the mantras that we chant. So everybody remember we talked about that in regard to the Prasadam prayer and other mantras that we chant? So right now we're going to chant first the Pranam Prat mantra to Srila Prabhupada, which is Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pastaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakta Vedanta Swami Namani Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pachani Nivastasya Sanyavadi Paschata Dejitar, which means, so while we chant these mantras, we want to concentrate on the meaning of the mantras. And the meaning to Prabhupada's first mantra is, I offer obeisances unto the lotus feet of His divine grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami. Prabhupada is so dear to Lord Krishna, having taken shelter at the Lord's lotus feet. So you can actually picture or visualize Srila Prabhupada taking shelter at Krishna's lotus feet. And, of course, the second mantra is more indicative of Prabhupada's own mission. Namaste Saraswati Devi. That you're the servant or empowered by Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Stay Saraswati Devi. Gauravani, with the message of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Pacharane, that's message. Then, and specifically, you've come to the Western world, Paschacha Dejantarani, Nirasesha Shunyavadi, to deal with all of us who are practically overcome with impersonalism and voidism. And actually, it's interesting, I pointed this out in Gita Nagari, that impersonalism and voidism, they're all imports from India. It's interesting, isn't it? How Indian culture has affected American culture quite a bit. There was another thing I mentioned that was an import from India. Does anyone remember what I said in the Gita Nagari seminar? What? Marijuana. Herbal medicine. Tobacco, no, that was imported into India by the British. Tobacco and tea are British imports from China and from other places, actually from America. America's tobacco. So we sent India our tobacco, and India sent us marijuana. So, good exchange. So getting back, as you see, I have a need to be funny. But anyway, so Prabhupada's Pranam Mantra, Paschacha Dejantarani, you've come to the Western world to free us from impersonalism and voidism. So if you actually think about that when you're chanting, of course there's the Panchatattva Mahamantra we're going to chant too. Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shidvaita Gadadha Shivasiddhi Gaur Bhaktivinoda. And generally when I chant the Panchatattva Mahamantra, I think of the members of the Panchatattva, specifically the deities in Sri Mayapur. You know, Panchatattva, big Panchatattva deities there. And, you know, it's very ecstatic. When you actually visualize, or some people can't visualize, some people can imagine, visualize, picture, whatever you want to say about it, the chanting becomes much more ecstatic. It's not mindless. And then, of course, the Hare Krishna mantra, you got Radharani there, Hare, in the Bhakti, you're calling out. Vakative form means you're calling out, "Oh Radharani." And Krishna is also in the vakative form too. "Oh Krishna, oh Ram." Because if you had in the nominative, here's a little Sanskrit for you. If you had the name of Krishna in the nominative form, it would be Krishnas, like Krishnas to Bhagavan Swayam. Like Krishna is the original Supreme Personality of God. So but all three words in the Maha Mantra are crying out. As Lord Chaitanya said, Ainanda Tanuja Kinkaram Patitam Mam Vishmay Bhavan Buddha Kripya Tava Pada Pankaja. Siddhaduli Sadrasambhaja the Chintaya. So, O son of Nanda Maharaj, I'm your eternal servant, etc. So, when we chant the Mahamantra, we should understand like crying out for Krishna or crying out for Radharani to engage us in Krishna's service. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. That's interesting. Some people say we're the Hare Krishna movement, but we're actually the Hare Krishna movement. You understand? Okay. So just chant, with that in mind, you know, try your best to visualize, or if you want to, if you're willing to, and we'll experience some ecstasy. All right? Nama Om Vishnu Pataya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Samin Iti namen hey. Can we respond? Namaste. Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharante Nivashesha Sunyavati Paschacha Desatarane Jaya Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Sivasari Gauravakavrinda Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Rama Hare Hare. Prabhupada, 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 Prabhupada. Jai Gaur Premananda Haribo. Jai Om Ganati Vidandasha Gananjana Shilakaya Chaksurun Miritam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. So let's start off by reading a quote from the Bhakti Loka by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur that deals with the subject matter we were talking about this morning. This is about needs. Everybody remembers? Basic needs. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, unless one makes the gross, unsubtle bodies favorable for devotional service, one cannot engage in such. Wow. Unless one makes the gross, unsubtle bodies favorable for devotional service, one cannot engage in such. There is a need for some arrangements in order to attain a favorable condition in these two bodies. First of all, to maintain the gross body, this Panchamahabhuta, there is a need to accumulate a house, household items. This, is, of course, is not for the brahmacharis, don't worry. Grains and drinks. For the prosperity of the subtle body, one needs proper knowledge and proper occupation. In order to make the bodies completely favorable for devotional service, there's a need to situate them above the modes of nature. In other words, whatever you do, whatever you offer, yad paroshi, yad asnashi, yad yohoshi, tadasya. Due to the results of fruitive activities from time immemorial, whatever nature and desires a living entity develops is certainly a mixture of goodness, passion, and ignorance. By first enriching the mode of goodness, one should diminish and defeat passion and ignorance and make goodness prominent. When the mode of goodness is completely under the control of devotional service, then it becomes nirguna. By following this gradual process, one's body, mind, and environment become fit for devotional service. In other words, we fulfill these basic needs in the mode of goodness. And not that one says, I have a need for fun, and then you go to the disco. You know, there's a mode of goodness way to deal with these basic needs if we want to advance in devotional service. If you don't want to advance in devotional service, then you go to hell. Oh, no, sorry. Then that's your choice. Everybody has a choice. I mean, we're not going to interfere with the living entity's free will. Neither does Krishna interfere with the living entity's free will. Okay. So, before we go on to the process of empathic communication, dealing with the blocks of communication, first of all, and the process itself, we're going to talk about something called domination culture, which is an interesting subject matter. And a domination culture means that we do things because of the imposition of authority, either with rewards or punishments, without connection to our own needs. And we mentioned this morning, like Hitler's Germany was one example of that. And there's religious organizations, like, not ISKCON, of course, but there was this Jonestown thing, I don't know if any of you heard about that, where there was a whole group of people, they went to Guyana, and the leader said, take poison Kool-Aid. You heard about this before? And 80 or 90% of them did it. And not only that, they fed the poison Kool-Aid to their children, to little babies. And this was like hundreds of people died in that particular encounter. So we have to engage ourselves according to free will. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna gives many instructions to Arjuna, but at the end, he says, now what do you want to do? Right? He doesn't say, if you don't do what I say, you're going to hell. Is there that verse in the Gita? Maybe I haven't read the Bhagavad Gita properly. He doesn't say, do what I say, or I shoot you. Do what I, or like a guilt trip, you know, you're killing me. I mean, just like when I joined the Hare Krishna movement, the story, which I usually tell stories about my mother, whom I love. She told me, she had people call me and said, your mother is dying because you joined the Hare Krishna movement. Some of you may be familiar with this sort of dynamic. Your mother is dying. How can you do this to her? Of course, I was a young brahmachari. I just said, well, if she dies thinking of me, then because I'm a devotee, back to Godhead, you know. Didn't have much empathy in those days, you know. You said, well, that'll be good for her. But anyway, you know, sometimes young people don't have that much empathy, or people who are not trained in empathy. So, but what happened is that she didn't die. She's still alive. She's 91 years old. And she drives a car, goes swimming and everything. She was good health. But it was a technique to try to get me to do what she wanted. Fortunately, I didn't listen to that particular technique. So in this domination culture, we oftentimes don't do or are not connected with our own needs, and we are controlled by others through guilt or guilt, punishment, or sort of like offering something to someone, like a present. You know, for example, I mean, let's give an example of what happens in ISKCON somewhere. So you should distribute books, because if you become number one on the Sankirtan parade, then you'll get an award for the best Sankirtan devotee of the year. Now, what happens when you do that is the people start liking awards better than doing Sankirtan. When the reward for something is extrinsic, I mean different than the actual thing that you're doing. Another example from my childhood is that when I was young, my mother would give me rewards for doing well in school. If I got an A, I would get $5. $5 then is worth a lot more than what it's worth today. It's like $20 or something like that. So she'd give me $5. If I got a B, I got $1. If I got a C, I got no dollars. If I got a D, I got a minus. So in this way, it didn't make me like to study. It made me like accounting. You know, at a very early age, like 5 or 6, I learned to be an accountant. Which is good, because I utilized that in the Krishna consciousness movement later on, being in charge of many temples. So I engaged that in Krishna's service. So this sort of culture we want to avoid. And I'm going to read a quote from Srila Prabhupada's books that illustrates how we need to have freedom in our own devotional service, and in transcendental life you have freedom. This is from the Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, 6th chapter, text 37. The verse is, Suta Goswami said, thus addressing Vyasadev, Srila Narada Muni took leave of him, and vibrating on his Veena instrument, he left to wander at his free will. Prabhupada says, every living being is anxious for full freedom, because that is his transcendental nature. And this freedom is obtained only through the transcendental service of the Lord. Illusion by the external energy, everyone thinks that he is free, but actually he is bound up by the laws of nature. A conditioned soul cannot freely move from one place to another, even on this earth, and what to speak of one planet to another. But a full-fledged free soul like Narada, always engaged in chanting the Lord's glories, is free to move not only on earth, but also in any part of the universe, as well as in any part of the spiritual sky. We can just imagine the extent and unlimitedness of his freedom, which is as good as that of the Supreme Lord. Whew. So, enough for that. Let's see if we can do some of these exercises. No, let's go on to the blocks of communication, because we don't have unlimited time. So, there are 4 blocks that discommunicate us or disconnect us from each other and from ourselves. And actually, there's more than that. There's more than 4, but these are the 4 main blocks we talk about in empathic communication or nonviolent communication. And we're going to go over each one. And they're all called four D's, because they all start with a D. The first one we touched upon this morning in terms of judgments, it's called diagnosis, where we label something or someone with a static label. Now, the interesting thing about diagnosis, we don't have this other chart up here right now, is that diagnoses are judgments, but when we make these diagnoses or judgments, they're not bad things. Remember, that's the other chart, but anyway, we forgot about it. They're not bad things. They help us understand what our needs are. For example, let's say I'm here in the temple, and forgive me, Mitch Anandabran. Well, he's not here. Oh, there you are. Let's say he's the temple president.
Let's not say that.
Let's not say that, okay. So let's say he tells me that there's no one to do the RT. You have to go and do the RT right now. And I just think in my mind, he is mean, he's a controller, he's not compassionate, he's not empathic. Why didn't he attend that seminar? He did attend the seminar and he didn't learn anything from the seminar. So I'm thinking all those things in my mind. So one may say, that's bad to think those things. It's not bad. What we want to do is hear those judgments and understand what they mean in terms of our needs that are not being fulfilled. In this particular case, my need for rest, or my need for freedom, or my need for autonomy, or something. Because the way he presented the deity worship to me was, you have to do it. You know, he's being very mean. You want to live in this temple? This is what you have to do. And so he was stimulating my expression of needs through a judgment. So when you make judgments, diagnosis, or label someone, it indicates something's going on with you. So be aware of the judgment. It's nothing bad. Emotions, feelings are not bad. We have to be aware of the connection to the needs. And just like the example I gave before in the previous seminar, was if you're in your car and you're driving, and the oil light goes on. Of course, they don't have oil lights anymore. That dates me. But anyway, if the light goes on and says engine or oil, is there anything wrong with the light? Some people will actually just disconnect the light. Right? Well, I solved the problem. You know, I cut the wire. You know, the lights are not on anymore. But the light indicates some particular need the car has, which is a need for oil or changing the oil or something like that. So this is called diagnosis. And actually, maybe you can write that down. The first D. Make a big D and say diagnosis. Okay. So here's an exercise. And This can be done, let's say, we can split into twos. If you can turn to the person next to you, or threes, if you like, twos or threes, and just do this real quickly. And what you want to do, diagnosis, what you want to do is, think of someone that said things that stimulated you to make a diagnosis. Think of one person, you know, and share it, that stimulated you to make a diagnosis of him, and give us the diagnosis. And we're going to be going around and asking you. You got 5 minutes to do it. Yeah. Yeah. No, 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 no. You think of a person who's not in this room, hopefully. Think of a person who's not in this room, if you were willing, and when he did something, he or she did something, what labels you put on them? How about that? How you diagnose them? You know, maybe it's your boss at work, maybe it's your husband, if he's not here. Maybe it's the temple president. Okay. Okay, we got 5 minutes. And you can share with each other. Wants to share some of the labels that they use when someone did something, said something, stimulated you. Yeah. Okay. Good in finding what?
Wrong reason.
So he's good at finding wrong reasons. Okay, that's the label you're putting on. Okay, now, no, we're going to drill down on this for a second. So what need do you have for putting that, what is your need? Can I guess? A need for fairness? Okay, we're going to do quickly. So one thing I'm pointing out here is when you're dealing with people and you're guessing their needs, that's all right to guess. You say, can I guess? You know, this is just a guess. And give them the space to correct you if you're wrong. People will be interested, just that you're interested in finding out their needs and feelings. Are you feeling really upset? When you talk about this person, are you feeling upset? That's how he is. Yes, that's your opinion. So that's how he is. But that's your opinion. Is it absolute? Good. This is a good point. Thank you for making that point. Many people think their opinions are absolute. For example, is it cold in this room now? Is that absolutely true? Why not? I'm not feeling cold right now. It's cold for you. So we have to be careful when we're talking to be objective. You can say it's, you know, centigrade, you know, it's 18 degrees. That's objective. So it's not that everybody thinks he's that way, do they? Okay. So one of the problems with labeling people is we want to be absolute. We're God. Here's a label for everybody. So thank you. You really brought out a lot with that. And of course, I guess that your need, a need for fairness, for fair treatment. And so the point is, when you guess, if someone corrects you, that's fine. Just the person's happy that you're guessing, that you're interested enough in them to figure out their need. It's really powerful, you know. No one ever asked me what my need is or anything like that. But anyway, whatever. I'm lamenting. So Another. Any other volunteers? Yeah.
I said
he's
paying enough attention.
He doesn't pay enough attention. He's inattentive. He's inattentive. And what was your need? I'm trying to connect the judgments with your basic need, why you made that judgment. I'm sure he's attentive when he's home with his wife, right? Maybe not. In the workplace. With you. You've been... Right, right.
And then we get the reply
that shakes other ways for the time. So, all right, so he's inattentive. Why, what is your need that you're saying that?
My need is doing enough research and putting the things.
That's not a need, but your need is, you know, probably respect. Respect for your work. And here's an interesting thing. What is his need? Try to guess.
To communicate.
No, he's been inattentive. You say he's inattentive, so that's your judgment. Judgments are usually expressions of unmet needs. So your judgment is he's inattentive. So if you have to guess, you know, he's probably feeling frustrated because he needs a break. He's maybe feeling overwhelmed. See, this is a higher step in empathy. First, to understand your own needs and not blame him. Now when you label him inattentive, how do you feel? What's your feeling? From the heart. Not a judgment.
Restless.
Restless. Frustrated.
Again. And
are you blaming him for making you restless and frustrated? Yes. That's the next step we're going to talk about. It's interesting. And so who else? Yes. Poor devotee. So, I mean, of course, your need is for respect for the deities. Obviously, respect and loyalty, maybe truthfulness, because he may be lying about not taking a shower, or maybe he isn't. So, anyway, we're not going to try to guess at his need. That'd be too much. But, in other words, how are you feeling about it? You feel distressed. Distressed, frustrated.
Yes.
So, in other words, she has needs and she has feelings. This is the process we're showing right here. You're observing something and you're feeling distressed. And you have a need. You have a need for, you know, respect to the deities, of course. And maybe truthfulness if he's not telling the truth. So the point I'm making is when we have these diagnoses, they separate ourselves from being compassionate to the person. Because there's obviously some reason why he's coming. And we're also blaming the person for our own emotions. Which is the next step. So let's say one or two more, and then we'll...
When an employee calls off and we're calling off because of the work, you just label them as, like, you know that they're lying, you know that they're irresponsible.
Irresponsible. So you're labeling them as irresponsible, Because you have a need for responsibility. I mean, that's a really easy one. You have a need for, and how do you feel about that? And what's your emotion, your heart emotion on that?
It's disturbing.
You're disturbed, confused maybe?
Kind of angry too.
Angry, okay. Angry. And so you're angry because of your own need. Interesting. And of course you have a need for responsibility or whatever. In this particular case, you see that everybody's seeing the connections between those things? And you're not connecting with the person. That person has their own, remember what I talked about in the beginning? Has their own motivation, and their motivation is to fulfill a particular need. I'm not going to guess at their need, why they're not acting in the way that you would consider to be responsible right now. But there's some need. There's something, maybe in this particular case, their child got sick or something. Maybe someone died in their family. Maybe they're in financial distress and they're just like have a need for peace. So there may be so many things going on in their lives that we're not aware of. So anyone else? One other sharing. Yeah, back there. Yeah.
And she immediately started complaining about the principal, so I lived her.
You did what?
I lived with her as a gossiper, like your guest.
A gossiper.
I felt like really cautious around her, that I didn't want to get involved.
So be aware, another case like that, be aware of the label. What is your need? You have a need for, let me just try to guess, tell me if I'm wrong, straightforward communication, not talking behind other people's backs, being open, honest.
Yeah.
Honesty, good. So you have a need for honesty, therefore you're feeling frustrated in dealing with her?
Yeah, oh. I'm cautious, like I wouldn't want to be around her.
Yeah, you're avoiding her.
Yeah.
Okay. Because of your needs. So, all right, so that brings us, oh yeah, that brings us to the second D of this communication, ready? Which is called denial of responsibility. Because notice, in all the cases practically that we talked about of diagnosis, people blame the other person for their own feelings, for their own reaction, and for the diagnosis. Let me explain what I mean. We have many times we use this denial of responsibility, even in our own spiritual lives or in the temple. We say, if a devotee gets angry, I'm angry because I'm a conditioned soul. You ever hear that one before? You know, I can't control my senses because I'm a conditioned soul. You know, sometimes I ask someone to do something, and I said, you know, I just say unempathically, I can do it, and they say, it's easy for you because you're a pure devotee. So people are making excuses, you know, I lied because the temple president told me to lie. I'm feeling this. You know, I got angry at work the other day because this person was late. So we're blaming other people, not taking responsibility for our own actions, our own feelings, our own needs. Part of empathic communication or nonviolent communication is taking responsibility to fulfill our needs and understanding every single feeling you have is due to needs that are met or unmet. You know, sometimes we have feelings that are met needs. You know, like if someone cooks nicely, you know, we met our needs for tasty food, met our needs for nutritious food. So that's a feeling, which we're going to talk about feelings in a few minutes, or hopefully this afternoon, about what feelings are and what judgments are, and what feelings come from the heart and judgments come from the head. So remember here, observation, we see something or something happens, and then we have certain feelings, not judgments. Feelings can be described as something that you don't use the word, I feel like you're an idiot. That's not a feeling. Feelings are from the heart, like I'm feeling happy, I'm feeling angry, I'm feeling satisfied. I mean, there's so many feelings we can have. And then the process is understanding our feelings and then understanding the needs that are fulfilled or unfulfilled. We'll go through that chart in a few minutes. So the second block of communication is actually denial of responsibility. Like we mentioned, the Nazis did it. I was ordered to do something, therefore I committed these activities. As I say, it denies responsibility. I don't have any exercise. We're not going to do an exercise because of that. Okay, that's the second D. The third one is called demands. We talked about that this morning, when not in such a systematic way, but when you demand someone to do something, the definition of a demand is if they don't do it, then you're going to get angry. There's going to be some repercussions for them. So when we approach people with the mood of request rather than demand. If you are willing to do something. And if someone says no, then we say no. We'll look for another strategy. So does anyone here enjoy hearing a demand? Raise your hand if you enjoy hearing a demand. You do. You enjoy hearing a demand? Oh, you enjoy giving demands? No, all right, let's finish with this first, then you can ask a question. Like, demand, does anyone here, let's say you're cooking for your husband, wife, or someone else, and someone says, you have to cook for me. It's your duty. I do that? No. You're a rascal. You're a demon, useless, hopeless rascal. Because I have a need for worship. I'm demonstrating what not to do, obviously. So, let's say, if you demand something, it's not pleasant to reciprocate with that particular demand. And if someone does something because they, to get to that point, they have to do it, which we talked about this morning, it's not pleasant to receive from them. For example, if someone is cooking for you, or cooking, let's say he's cooking for me, and the person has the mood that they have to do it, I don't want to eat what they're cooking. It's not pleasant. If someone says to me, I'm cooking for you because I have to do this, then better you just take your cooking somewhere else. So the demands bring out that particular energy. Okay, we already did demands, actually the first part of the seminar, where we wrote down the things you have to do, thought about the things you have to do. So let's... Okay, two exercises, real quickly. If some of you can tell me, when you remember giving something without being a demand... Without being a demand from the other person, how you felt. How did you feel to do something for someone else when they didn't demand it from you? What was the feeling? Any volunteers? Yeah, but can you explain the situation? Okay. Yes, when they're not asking for it. And you do it.
Yeah.
And how do you feel?
Very good.
That's good. And so, when there's no demands, the relationship becomes sweeter. There's more connection in that particular relationship. And that makes you happier. That's really empathy. Because we are all, by nature, empathetic or empathic. And one of the highest enjoyments you can get is giving empathy or doing something for someone when you're not asked to do it. I'll give you an example. At the last seminar in Gita Nagari, there was one of the devotees who came with me who didn't get adequate prasadam. The reason she didn't get adequate prasadam was because she didn't want to eat food that would kill her. You know, too spicy, too hot, too sugary, and everything like that. She was had a need to remain alive. I give another seminar called Stop Killing the Devotees, if you're interested in that seminar. That's on the internet. Just look it up. YouTube, Stop Killing the Devotees. You'll be able to see about that. So anyway, so what I did is that I was staying in a house outside of Gita Nagari in Bhaktachirthamaraj's house. And I cooked extra prasadam and I brought it to her. And because she didn't ask for that, because I did it, I felt very happy, satisfied. So when you do something for someone when they're not asking for it, not demanding it, there's a great satisfaction there, a great connection there. So this is one of the items of empathy. All right. Demands, let's see. Okay. Let me ask another question. If someone theoretically asked you for something as a demand, can you rephrase it as a request? Think about it. When someone told you to do something, how would you rephrase it? Or when you told someone to do something, how would you rephrase it as a request? Let's say if you're temple president or in charge of a yatra, and you say you have to do this, how would you rephrase it? Nityananda Brahm?
I don't know, that's why I'm
interested. Any, we're trying to have you participate. Yeah, is it possible for you to do it? Okay, anyone have any other situations? Yes.
Now, once on the receiving end of a demand, is it appropriate to rephrase it into form of a request?
You might have some problem if you did that. You say, would you rather say... If you're willing to do it, you know, the person may be stimulated to get angry at that particular juncture.
They might say, would you back your bags, please?
Yeah, you have to be careful about that. But when we're making demands, it's important not to make demands, but when we're requesting someone to do something, it's important to have the idea or the concept in our minds that even if they don't do that, that's all right. We'll find someone else to do it. Except in an emergency. There's certain times when demands are important. Like if you see a child crossing the street and he's going to get run over, what do you do? Get out of there! In those circumstances, yes, demands are appropriate. But otherwise, it evokes people's need for autonomy. And they will either rebel or be submissive. Neither alternative is desired. You know, if they rebel, obviously. But if they're submissive, they're doing things with the wrong, especially in devotional service or in any sort of relationship, they're doing things with the wrong attitude. Like if someone's on the altar and they're just doing this arti, you know, When will it be over? And a one, and a two, and a three, and a four, and a five. When is this? Oh, my God. You think Krishna's accepting it? I don't. Krishna says, offer me leaf, fruit, or little water, but how? With love and devotion. He doesn't say, just, you know, throw it at me. And Krishna reciprocates on the altar like that, too. Many times, and I used to worship Radha and Krishna regularly on the altar, even here. Many times, the pujari will go on the altar after making an offering, and you'll find the plates on the floor with all the food. Anyone's experienced that? I have. Not because it wasn't my fault. It was the cook's fault. So. So. Nothing is my fault. So Krishna won't accept it. He knows your mood. He knows what's in your heart. How is he going to accept it? Another time I remember in San Diego years ago, the devotees woke up one morning and Subhadra was gone. There was just a burnt mark in the middle of the altar and there was no Subhadra. And Prabhupada said that's because offenses were being made. Prabhupada said, you know, Radharani will actually view what you're offering to Krishna, and if she doesn't like the consciousness of whatever, she won't offer it to Krishna. It'll be boga at that particular point. So it has to be offered with love and devotion. So with between ourselves too, there should be that mood of service. You know, dadati pratigrinati guyamakyati prachati bhunkte bhojate chaiva. It makes life very pleasant. So that's the second D of discommunication. And the next one is deserve. That's a big one.
Question.
What?
Question.
Okay, question.
So, if there's no choice.
What's that? Let me get in the microphone.
So, if there's no choice, right, for example, in this case, they are the answer to be done, and there's no reality for the other thing, and you're asking the person, so we're just.
Well, yeah, there's you. See, what I've experienced as far as being a temple president, which I've done before, is that the buck stops with the temple president, right? And if there's no one to do the arti, you get on the altar. And you're choosing to be temple president, I hope. But unless you're told you have to be temple president, because I'm quitting. So, yeah, I mean, that's how the authorities should be dealing with things in Krishna consciousness. Because we're supposed to, this is devotional service. It's not, you know, karma yoga. It's devotional service. So we're supposed to be serving Krishna from the heart with devotion. And the authority has to be ready to do it themselves if no one else will do it. That's a good temple president. Right?
Yeah.
You're the boss. So, all right, yes. Yeah, that's another problem. You have a question. Yeah.
I'm not sure if at this point in the context of devotional service, but in general life,
yeah,
there are certain contracts we sign. For example, let's say the workplace, when I say I'm an employee, I'm signing a contract that there can be demands that I have to follow.
Yes, but you've agreed to that. But you've agreed. You always have a choice to not agree to the contract or not. But you've chosen. In other words, you take personal responsibility. I've chosen. I've made this contract. I've taken initiation. I've chosen to vow to chant 16 rounds a day. So I don't see it as a demand. Because I made that choice. I'm taking personal. The whole point is to take personal responsibility.
So when the visitor workplace.
Yeah, in the workplace, yes.
They can say, okay, this is the project you have to do. They may not always say, would you like to, would you have a choice? It's not like that, necessarily.
No, I understand in the workplace. This is not a system of management.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
We may have to live with certain demands.
Yes.
There are certain demands that may, I guess, cross the line, which is where we have to then say whatever we have to say. But then certain demands will keep coming.
Yeah, there's certain requirements. But you're choosing it every minute.
Yes.
To do that. Okay. Yes, in certain management situations in the business world, yes. That is true. Okay. Anyone else about demands? Yes. That's not your responsibility to fulfill anyone else's unfulfilled needs. But the basic point is to hold a mirror, yes, like you say, help them understand their needs. That's facilitation. Yeah, because that's called codependency, as you're probably aware. When you feel yourself responsible, like, you know, the wife sometimes feels herself responsible for fulfilling all the needs of the husband, and you end up with a relationship that's really strained. We did mention this in Gita Nagari, that when people first get married, and I'm not an expert in marriage, thank God, so then they see the other person as fulfilling all their needs, you know, social, you know, love, cooking, you know, the typical thing for, this is to warn you, brahmacharis, that someone will iron all your clothes. And then you'll get your clothes back with a little rose on it or something like that. It's like that story of the Brahmin and his underwear. You know the story? Maybe I should tell that real quickly. So the Brahmin, he tried to make a solution to a problem he had. The problem he had was the rats were eating his underwear. You know the story? Okay, it's good for the brahmacharis to know all the stories. So the rats were eating his underwear, so he thought, well, I got to get rid of rats, so let me get a cat. So he got a cat, and the cat actually had hunger, was not satisfied just with rats. The cat wanted milk, so he had to get a cow to take care of the cat that wanted milk, the cat that was eating the rat. And then the cow needed to be milked, so he thought, let me get someone to milk the cow. Let me get married. So he got married, he got his wife to milk the cow, but then he discovered the wife had needs too. She wanted saris and children and everything like that. And the poor guy, in order to fulfill one need, just to have underwear that wasn't eaten by the rats, had to get a job and move here to Chicago. So getting back to the point. The story of your brahmacharis. So when people get married, there's an initial stage. It's called La La Land, which is described by the brain surgeons, or, you know, people do brain scans, as just like when one takes cocaine. So anyway, so they think, you're everything to me. I mean, I don't know this, but I mean, I've just watched enough Bollywood movies to know what I'm talking about. You're everything to me. You're everything to me. We'll live forever in love. You know, so later on they discover they have needs, and you know, when they start demanding the other person fulfill their needs, then you end up with conflicts. Sounds familiar? Yeah, unmet needs, and then you're demanding, you know, you said you'd be always there for me. I need someone to play cricket with me. So the poor wife doesn't want to play cricket. I mean, what? She wants to go shopping. And she thinks, I want someone to go shopping with me. Well, the point is they're each demanding for each other to fulfill their needs. And what that creates is a marriage that's on the rocks at that particular juncture. People need to take responsibility. That's what denial is. Take responsibility for fulfilling their own needs. And that means that the husband will have to find a friend to play cricket with. And the wife will have to find a friend to go shopping with. Because, you know, nothing frustrates a man more than having to sit in the store while his wife is shopping and trying on all the different saris, isn't it? You can ask the men that. It's just like, it's torture. It's against the United States Constitution, you know. You didn't like that one. All right, so basically, we take responsibility. This is what denial means. We take responsibility for our own feelings and needs. If I have a need to go somewhere and someone's not willing to do it, I'll find some other alternative. I'll think outside the box. Like that. So that's a very important principle, this denial. Now, as far as in the work situation, like you mentioned, yes, you've agreed to do a certain thing, but you always have a choice. You can not do it, and then you lose your job. That's your choice. You're not being forced. You're not really being forced to do anything. You can always choose. And you've agreed to that situation. Okay, so any other questions about denial of responsibility? No? And yes? Demands. Oh, you have a question about demands. All right. Well, there are several things you can do. You can ask the other person, if they heard what you said as a demand, you can ask the person, what did you hear that I said? And then they'll communicate with you, you're saying that I better do this. And then you could say, that really wasn't my intention. My intention is, if you're willing with your heart to do this, then it's fine. And if you're not, I'll seek some other alternative. So there's way back and forth communication. That's one scenario. Okay? Any other questions before we go on to the final D of discommunication? Oh, you got it down there already. Deserve. Everybody's ready for that? Deserve means actions deserve reward or punishment, which we talked about before. Extrinsic actions that are not connected with the actual thing that you want someone to do or not to do. For example, with the studying in school, doing well in school, let's say we want someone to do well in school or someone to like to study, we need to encourage them with the love of obtaining knowledge. That's intrinsic. Everyone understands intrinsic. In other words, the reward for a particular activity should be the activity itself. Like, I'm speaking here in the seminar or workshop because the activity I like, I'm learning, I'm connecting with all of you, I'm getting all these things. But if the reward was that I'm giving seminars because Nityananda Prabhu is going to write me a check for $10,000 after, which is not going to. It's not really, that's just, it's a joke. But if I was doing that, and you know, if I was doing that because I deserve it, you know, I'm a sannyasi, you know, bow down, mister. You know, an interesting example of something like that was that, I came to Gita Nagari and I'm staying in Bhaktivedanta's house, and Brajalila received me. You all know Brajalila, very nice devotee. And she was apologetic. She said, "We don't have a garland to give you." I said, "That's all right. Yeah, who cares? Garland. Sticks and stones would break my bones. Whatever, you know." And she said, "Many times the sannyasis get really angry when they don't get a garland." I was thinking, oh my God, what movement did I join here? And it's like, is Durvasa Muni joining our Hare Krishna movement now? I mean, can you imagine? Where's my garland? Where's my obeisance? Where's my guru puja? Where's my foot bathing? I deserve it because of my position. You know, that attitude, you know, that I deserve, or someone else, you know, someone else deserves punishment for something like that, it just really disconnects you from people. So Krishna will give us what we deserve. And that's also a demand. You know, all these different four D's of discommunication are actually connected with each other. Because when a sannyasi doesn't receive his garland, he's demanding his garland. And he thinks he deserves a garland. And he makes a diagnosis. This person is in Maya. And he says, he made me angry. You understand? So denial of responsibility, he's blaming. It's a good example. He's blaming the other person for his anger. And our anger is our responsibility. It's because of unfulfilled needs. Blaming the other person, making a diagnosis, demanding, and I deserve to be worshipped. Interesting, isn't it? And he's disconnected. So, you know, when I went to see, you know, to see Brajalila, I was thinking, you know, if they offer me a garland, it's nice, out of devotion, it's nice, and if they don't, you know, whatever. Whatever. Someone cooks for me, it's nice, and if they don't cook for me, I can cook for myself. I'm an adult. So, any questions about deserve there? Deserve, yes. Okay. Let's say it's not the best mood to connect to Krishna with. First of all, Krishna is taking care of you throughout the day, even if you don't chant nicely, but he's always nicho nicho nam chaitanya chaitanya namah eko bohanam yovadadati kama. He's taking care of all living entities. And he'll give you different reactions according to your devotion or lack of devotion. You know, yayatamam prapajantate tam sataiva bhajamiham. And if you're chanting with that mood, I'm chanting so Krishna will make sure everything runs nicely. Actually, he has another verse. Yashaham anugrinami harishe tadadam shanai. Krishna says, for those who are especially devoted to... I'm not going to mention. Anyway, I better not use that verse. I'll scare all of you away. To those who especially chant nicely, I take away everything to their friends and relatives and reject them. So there's other sides to that, particular objective in chanting nicely. My feeling is we should chant nicely to connect to Krishna. And of course, if you have some other motive, be honest with Krishna about it. You know, I'm chanting because I want a kingdom greater than that of Lord Brahma, like Dhruva Maharaj. Akama sarva kama moksha kama dharati tivrena bhakti yogeni yajeta purusham param. So, just to think I deserve something, it disconnects you from Krishna. I deserve to be treated nicely. I deserve everything to go right. I mean, just like I was thinking, I mentioned in the other seminar that Krishna, all right, I had an operation recently, just a hernia operation, just a simple thing. And I was thinking, Krishna, I served you all these years, gave you everything, and look what you're doing to me. I deserve better than this. Another thing is, I look in the mirror and see an old man looking back at me. So I said, Krishna, I get that everything, and you just gave me an old body as a present. I deserve more than that. It really disconnects us from a relationship with Krishna, because the important thing is empathy, relationship, connection with Krishna. That's really what gives you pleasure. We're talking about being happy. Happiness comes from connection. Happiness comes from empathy. A natural part of our soul psychology is empathy. We told this story in Gita Nagari that... Actually, I have two stories to tell about it. One story is that once upon a time there was a lady who was skin diving or scuba diving in the water. And a whale, big, big whale came up and started pushing her and pushing her and pushing her. And eventually the whale put her under its fin. You know, big fin. And she was scared like anything. What happened is that after she finally got out of the water, thinking she was going to die, the whale was going to torture her, she found out the whale was actually pushing her away from the sharks to protect her. So there's a whale, a different species than a human being, exhibiting empathy and compassion, for another living entity. And we all have that need for that. And that need is the most satisfying thing. Of course, connection with Krishna. But when you connect with Krishna, you're also intimately connected with everybody else. Because everybody else is part and parcel of Krishna. And so all living entities have that need. Another story that was just told to me during the break was that there was this lady in Germany. Actually, it was by email. This lady in Germany was walking by the Rhine River, a devotee. She was walking by the Rhine River. Rhine River is one of the rivers in Germany. And she noticed there was a goose. That means, anyway, a big duck. For those of you who don't know what a goose is. And the goose was just lying there. The goose was sick. So she sat down near the goose, not to frighten the goose, but just to give the goose some chanting. There was some distance between her and the goose. And the goose actually started crawling to her and basically put his head on her lap and was trying to connect to her. And she chanted for the goose. The goose left the body and went back to God. No, I don't know if the goose went back to Godhead, but the goose at least took a human birth in his next life. Prabhupada told me when I was... a Gurukul teacher, I was a nice Gurukul teacher, that when you feed, because we were feeding the ducks prasadam on Sunday, old Prashanam Bread Prabhupada said that ducks became human beings in the next life. So there's an instance of like a human being and an animal connecting really empathically, and that's natural in our psychology, the psychology of the soul. And that's what gives the greatest happiness. And of course, connect empathically to Krishna. What are Krishna's needs? Like Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Krishna are feeling anxiety. What is that anxiety? Because we're here. He loves us. He has a need for our happiness. And so if we reciprocate with him to fulfill that need by, you know, helping other people, bring people to Krishna consciousness, becoming Krishna conscious ourselves, that's connection to Krishna. And that's the greatest happiness. Okay. Any other questions? Yes. Yes.
Similarly, as a parent, so earlier you mentioned, you know, we are responsible for our own needs.
Yeah.
But as a parent, I have needs for my children.
Yes.
Happiness.
That's true.
Okay, so that's not, you know, that's not denial of responsibility.
No, it's definitely a need. It's definitely a need. And in relationships, we have a need for other people's happiness. That's empathy. That's good.
And yet, you know, I'm wondering if that, you know, our needs are distinct from other people's needs.
Yeah.
Need for harmony in a house is a valid need.
Yes, definitely a valid need, and their need to play is a valid need, and have fun is a valid need. So we try to work out some strategy where everyone's needs are fulfilled. You say, would you be willing to play during this time or play outside, rather than saying, stop that playing. Because they'll hear that as a demand. Anything you're told not to do, you want to do. That's natural. Anything, like when you use the word no, people hear it as yes. That's just natural psychology. Because you can't do a don't. It's impossible. So I just, when someone tells me you can't do that, you're not supposed to do something, I just get very enthusiastic to do it. Yeah, especially with children. That's the need for autonomy. So you have to be careful how to say no without saying no. You know, respect their need. It's wonderful you're playing. That's wonderful. However, you know, I have a need. You know, I'm feeling, you know, the whole process, I'm feeling a headache right now. Would you be willing to play in a half an hour from now? And of course, they say no. Would you be willing to play outside? Would you be willing to cook your own dinner tonight? No. Anyway, there's different ways of dealing with it. Life's supposed to be fun.
Yes. And you know, we often hear that, like, you know, Thakur says life is full of embarrassing and uncomfortable situations.
Yes.
And, you know, this world is the Kali and Shastra meant to
correct. Yeah.
So I want to understand, you know, our high emotional service, because we're feeling connected to Krishna, even though the material circumstances may be embarrassing and uncomfortable.
Yeah. So let's say something embarrassing, uncomfortable, disturbing happens. It depends on how you see it. Like we often say, instead of seeing it as a problem, you see it as a challenge and an opportunity. This is an opportunity. Like some sickness is an opportunity. And you take that in a positive way. It really things, how you see things depends on how you see things. You know, I'm not saying if someone dies, you say, this is a lot of fun here. But you take it as an opportunity to learn about Krishna consciousness. Like I've had experiences, as many leaders in the Krishna consciousness movement have had, of people criticizing you on the internet. This is a common thing. I mean, just Google any leader's name and you'll find 10,000 things that they didn't do wrong. So, you know, when I hear this criticism, I mean, first of all, it feels a little painful because I have a need for understanding. But I take this as a learning experience, as an opportunity to actually be more compassionate, to be more tolerant, to develop some Vaishnava qualities. So in the end, it does become something that's a positive experience. And you see that, let's say His Holiness Bhakta Tirthamaraj, when he was leaving this his body with it, you know, the cancer and everything like that, he was turning it into a positive experience to teach others. His idea was to teach others how to leave the body in a Krishna conscious way. And he wasn't depressed at all. He was seeing it as Krishna's arrangement. Yomam pashyati sarvatra sarvam chamayi pashyati. Anyone know that verse? Tashaham na prashami sachame na panashyati. 6:30, Bhagavad Gita, if any of you are interested. It means, one who sees me everywhere and sees everything in me is never lost to me, nor am I ever lost to him. This is like, to me, it's one of the nutshell verses of the Bhagavad Gita. To see Krishna everywhere. So when something happens, let's take Dharma the Bull in the Bhagavad Gita, in the Bhagavatam. Dharma the Bull is being beaten by the personality of Kali. Dharma the Bull is asked by Parikshit Maharaj, who has done this to you? Dharma the Bull doesn't say, it's Kali, kill him. He deserves to be killed. He gives a very philosophical answer, but the basis of that answer is understanding Krishna, the Krishna principle. It's Krishna's arrangement. And, of course, Kali Yuga coming and everything like that. So to see Krishna everywhere, see everything in Krishna, means whatever Krishna does to us or happens outside of our control is Krishna's arrangement. Not everything is Krishna's arrangement. If you overeat, it's not Krishna's arrangement. If you get angry, it's not Krishna's arrangement. You know, sometimes people will say to you, like an authority in the Krishna conscious movement will say, I'm angry with you. This is Krishna's arrangement that you're being punished. Can't blame everything on Krishna. Certain things we have responsibility for, but things outside of our purview or ability to control, we take as Krishna's arrangement. And an opportunity. There's, you know, many successful people in the world, or I would say most successful people in the world, don't see problems. They see opportunities and challenges, right? There's a challenge. I mean, so many big successful businessmen have seen things like that, just opportunities and challenges. Yes. Microphone.
I have seen many that like we reserve our best behavior for the strangers. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This involves something like expectations, which is a type of demands. When we have unrealistic expectations of people, we're demanding, you know, implicitly, we're demanding a certain type of action, behavior of someone, and we get angry when they don't reciprocate in the way that we think is appropriate. With strangers, we basically don't have any expectations. You know, at least one expectation is at least they won't punch us or steal from us or something like that. Of course, we're here in Chicago, you never know. But generally, you know, we don't have, like if I approach a stranger and I don't have any expectations they're going to help me cross the street or do anything for me. But if I approach Mayapur here, he has to do a lot of things. Because, you know, he's a slave. He oftentimes addresses me as master, just to tease me. And just to test him sometimes, like when I had my operation, he was assisting me. So just to test him, sometimes I call him on the phone and say, "Oh, Mayapur, I'm suffering, help." And he would get all nervous. So I think just a test to see if he was doing what he's supposed to do, like that. No, it was actually a funny relationship. So unrealistic or even expectations from someone destroy relationships. We're talking about a relationship, not the building, not the business field right now. Relationships. So that's a demand. So we have to be very careful about that. And so with people who are close to us, we have all these implicit demands, expectations. Like if Chumbaga didn't cook for me tonight, I have this demand. And then I would get angry. Not really. Not really. Not really, because I like my own cooking better. So 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 anyway, that's the point about people who are close to us. And there's more violence in the home than anywhere else. You know, it's more dangerous to walk into your home and say, "I'm home, dear," than to go into the most dangerous area of Chicago late on Saturday night. I mean, statistically, I'm not saying you're not saying in your particular case, but the statistics don't lie, because we have these demands, and when demands aren't met, we get angry. And when anger is there, there could be violence. You know, most of the time when the police are called to go somewhere, I don't know about Chicago, but another place, it's domestic violence. Because of that demand. You're supposed to, you have to do something. Very important question you asked. Thank you for asking that question. Very good. So any other questions before we go on? Yeah. That's the microphone.
Maharaj, you were saying about extrinsic and intrinsic rewards. So grades seem to be a poor way of rewarding us.
Exactly. Exactly. She said that grades are a poor way of encouraging people to like to study. Because people will simply like grades. I mean, I'll tell you what I did, you know, just admitting. What I did when I was young, I did one, got one bad grade my whole life. So, and in the old days, we got report cards. And what I did is I went with invisible ink and I changed the grade. I showed it to my mother, "Sign here real quickly, Mom." And she signed, "Oh, got an A, fantastic." And I took it back and it changed to a C. So, you know, I was encouraged by the extrinsic rewards, like either money or grades or whatever it is. So we want to encourage children to like to learn. This is when dealing with children or dealing with adults. It's fun to learn, but that takes more time than just like doing a reward or a punishment is a very short, easy, efficient way to get something done. But to do it in an empathic way takes a lot of time, because you can sit with the child, you sit with the adult, and explain the reasons, their needs for studying. You know, it's learn new things. Learn about the universe. Learn about Krishna consciousness. Learn who you are. Isn't this exciting? So make learning like that too. I remember one time in one temple, which shall remain nameless, they made people go to Mangalarti, and if they showed up late for Mangalarti, they had to write the Hare Krishna mantra out, I think 1,000 times, if I remember correctly. Now, people started to show up on time for Mangalarti. That's true. But were they happy doing it? They weren't as inclined to connect to the Mangalarti itself. They didn't have the reason that I'm going to Mangalarti because I want to connect to the deities. The deities are so beautiful. We can dance, we can chant, connect to the holy names. But it was out of fear. Oh my God, if I'm late for Mangalarti, I got to write the Hare Krishna. And you're punishing someone with a Hare Krishna Maha Mantra? That's an interesting punishment. One devotee called his japa, japa purgatory. Because he was behind 100 rounds, so he had to make up the rounds. And sometimes the parents will punish the kids, like do food punishments. You know, you have to eat everything on your plate or else you can't go play. Or you have to eat everything before I give you the sweets or something. Anyway, there's different food punishments. Or you have to eat when the kid's not hungry. Another result of doing that, you know, forcing the kids to eat when they're not hungry, is that later on when they get older, they won't understand when they're full and when they are hungry, and they'll have a tendency to they may have a tendency to overeat. Kids, children generally know when they're hungry. I mean, there's exceptions. There's exceptions. Children generally know when they're tired. So we have to be careful in dealing with children or in adults the same way.
Need or is it a strategy?
In different circumstances, it can be a need. In different circumstances, it can be a strategy. Because punctuality, generally, to me, means responsibility. Being responsible, being attentive to other people's needs, which is a need, like that. So, but I also have a need for punctuality. To me, it's an important part of my psyche. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Or, and then other times when it's a healthy, it's driven by healthy concerns, things like that. So, I mean, is that true for many people?
Yes. Yeah, certain things, certain times punctuality can be a need or can be a strategy.
So, it's a strategy when it's not really.
It's not punctuality for punctuality's sake. You know, then it's. It could be sometimes a demand, that you're demanding someone to be punctual. Well, anyway, there's all sorts of different reasons. But in certain circumstances, these different items can be demands or strategies. They're not necessarily always needs. Yeah. Yeah, that's an intrinsic need that all of us have.
And also the personal needs that we have. So it's almost like this parallel thing of selfishness and selflessness. And you explained what I'm understanding is that we have to make a strategy. We have the responsibility to have a strategy. We have to have these two things side by side.
Well, first of all, you got to take care of your own needs before you can think about other people's needs. Like if you're extremely hungry, it's going to be very hard to think about Krishna consciousness or other people's needs like that. Unless you're very advanced in Krishna consciousness. So
then when we make a strategy,
yeah. Right.
Understanding, maybe we have a wrong understanding of our needs, and then sometimes we're affected by these four things.
Yeah.
Yeah. And fulfill the demands that I have, those ideas, then that may
Disconnection. Yeah.
So how exactly do you deal with these situations, you know, like that?
Well, I can give a practical demonstration of that, but in a second. But first of all, you have to be connected to your own needs. You have to be introspective enough, and this takes some practice, not considering your emotions to be the product of anyone else's actions or words. That you're taking full responsibility. We talk about this denial over there. I take full responsibility for all my feelings, and I take full responsibility for all my needs. And without doing that, without being introspective enough to do that, then you're not going to be able to take care of anyone, not take care of other people's needs, but to be empathic with other people. Empathy begins at home first. Empathy begins at home. And unless you're peaceful, having taken care of all your material and spiritual needs, or have a strategy to take care of all your material and spiritual needs, you're not going to be empathetic or empathic. It means being introspective. Now let me show you an example of that. And this has to do with anger. This is the four chair example that some of you saw. I need four chairs up here. Facing this way. And I'm gonna be the actor in this case. So I'm gonna ask for a volunteer to insult me. Not you, Maivor. All right, Maivor has to operate the camera. Come here and I can tell them how to insult me. No, not you. What?
You point someone.
Appoint someone?
In this situation, you can demand someone.
All right. Nishana probably won't insult me. Okay, I'll tell you what to say to insult me, since it won't be coming from you.
It's going to be recorded tomorrow.
I know. And you could say you know, something like, you're a boring old man. You have no, you know, whatever you say has nothing to do with Shastra. You're a deviant. Okay.
I've been hearing you for almost 4 hours. And I never saw this thing in Prabhupada's books. I never saw this in fact, it's quite boring. I know you've been here 45 years, but it's kind of boring. I thought you would do more like kirtan and quote shlokas and all that.
It's good. You're doing a good job. Okay. So my immediate response is actually to blame myself. You know, to actually, not to blame you, said, yes, you're right. I'm fallen. You know, I'm doing all these diagnoses of myself right now. This is an illustration of the whole process. I'm fallen. I'm useless. I'm an offense to Prabhupada. I should just kill myself. It's just like hopeless. Okay, do the same thing again. I'm going to sit in the next chair.
So he stopped hearing you for almost 4 hours and brought this chance here. I had hoped you would quote some shloka, but I've never seen this in Prabhupada's books. In fact, it's turned out boring.
What do you know about Krishna consciousness? I'm an advanced devotee. I mean, you newbies. I mean, where did you get your training? I was with Prabhupada. You're an idiot. Hopeless, idiot, rascal. I mean, you're just like Prabhupada said, many members of the Krishna conscious movement will be, Bhaktivinoda Thakur said this, Kali Chelas. So notice, I need just to read it. The first one was I'm blaming myself. I'm giving myself diagnosis. The second one, I'm giving him diagnosis. And, you know, that's a standard way we generally deal with people who say something negative about us. It stimulates that. Okay. Do it again. Get an expert.
I've been hearing this for almost 4 hours, and I've not seen this in Prabhupada's books. We've drawn all these charts. I was hoping to hear more shlokas. I came out of aging, and this is, I don't know if this is really helpful to the devotees.
Okay, and so this particular response is, I want to be empathic with him, but I can't do it. I got to deal with my own emotions. When I heard Nityananda Prabhu say all these things, this is how I'll process it in my mind. What am I feeling? I'm feeling depressed. I'm feeling angry. Hopeless. Why? Because I have a need for appreciation. I have a need for love. I have a need for understanding. These are all my basic needs. So I'm feeling these because of my basic needs. And I'm going to seek some other, this is what's going on in my mind. I'm going to seek some other strategy to fulfill those needs. Obviously, he's not going to fulfill my needs. But I don't want to demand him to fulfill my needs. I'll seek some other strategy. That's what I have Mayapur and Champaka for. They'll come back and tell me tonight, they'll say, you are so wonderful, Guru Maharaj. We can't live without you. You're everything to us. I said, that's my strategy. So I'll be responsible. I'm not blaming you. I'm not in denial. I'm taking responsibility for my own needs and seeking another strategy. And so it doesn't bother me anymore. Also, you know, Krishna loves me. That's a great strategy. Krishna loves me. Krishna knows my heart. Even if everyone else thinks I'm an idiot, that's okay. I mean, this is a big thing, especially in Indian culture, reputation and everything like that. What do people say? What will everyone say behind my back? Like that. And so, but Krishna, then my strategy is Krishna loves me. So I can get up here, as you've seen, I give a seminar and say like some really wild, funny things, and I'm having a good time, and I know Krishna knows my heart. So I've dealt with my own emotions. Then you don't have to say it again. Then I move on to empathy for you. Now he can sit down now. But I move on to empathy for him. After I've dealt with my own feelings and needs, after I'm not blaming him or denial or any of those, or putting a label on him like I did over there, I moved on to that. And now I'm perfectly peaceful. Because you can't deal with other people's feelings and needs or try to be empathic with other people until your mind is peaceful. It just doesn't work. So now I'm thinking, you know, Nityananda Prabhu said this word, that word, whatever he said. I guess he may have a need for understanding. He's obviously, you know, it appears like he's angry. And of course, I can't guess, you know, what stimulated his anger, but basically, he has a need for understanding. He has a need for love. He has a need for compassion. And I won't say that. Because obviously, if someone says that to you, don't say, do you have a need for love? It's the worst thing you can say. So I'll feel that, and I'll say, would you be willing to talk about this? Could we meet later in a dark alley? I know. Could we meet later? I mean, I also have a need to improve my presentations. You know, I enjoy feedback. And if you could help, that would be great. And so automatically, when I start to say that empathically with him, then he's thinking, well, this guy's not so bad. And he'll meet with me and we'll have a better... I've connected with him. See, the whole point is not to get rid of his criticism, but to connect with him. That's pleasure. To connect with another living entity in a deep way, and to connect with Krishna in a deep way. That's the whole point. Connection, communication. Okay? So any questions about that exercise? Yes. Yeah.
For me, the takeaway from this exercise is to maybe be at the stage 3 and 4 at least. So my question is, Maharaj, oftentimes when the in that particular moment, if it is difficult for me to get to stage 3 or 4, how do I handle?
Take a break. Take a time out. You know, you can say, let's say if you're in a close relationship with a wife or something like that, you could say jokingly, do you want me to answer you empathically or non-empathically? And they'd say, empathically. Then let me take a little walk, please. You could say that. I mean, we need a time out. Usually you can't do things so instantaneously like that. It takes a lot of practice to be able to process like that real quickly. And most of us can't. I mean, I can't process that quickly. I just say, you know, give me a few minutes. And then I can just go and process, you know, what they said. Taking responsibility for my own feelings, not denying responsibility. Is he up there? Understanding these judgments I'm making, which is the diagnosis, means that I have needs that are not being fulfilled. But it takes time. It's like to practice empathic communication or being empathetic with other people, it's like a sadhana. It's not that you just take this course or go for a few hours with me and then just like, wow, I'm empathic now. I wish it was so easy. I mean, it's been a struggle for me to practice. It's been a struggle for me to practice this and continue to practice this. And I want to share it with everybody else, but I can't say that I'm empathic in every situation. I mean, you could ask Mayapur, I'm not empathic in every situation. You rascal. So it takes practice. Practice and introspection. Why am I thinking like this? Why am I passing a judgment like this? Why am I denying this? What is my underlying motive? And then you go back to the needs. Everything is based in the needs, right here. Everything is based in the needs. That's why we started talking about needs. Okay, we have like a half minute left this morning, yeah.
Second question. You mentioned about strategies in the morning class. I'm trying to understand what is the difference between being strategic and being diplomatic?
Well, diplomatic means you're not revealing or you're not aware of what your feelings and needs are, and you're saying something different, lying. That's what diplomacy means. Diplomacy means you're saying, oh, what a nice class, when you thought it was lousy. That's diplomacy. But strategic would mean that you, instead of, you know, maybe you don't comment on the class, or maybe you just say, could I give you some suggestions on how to improve your class? I mean, that's strategic. But diplomacy means to say one thing, you know, a forked tongue, saying one thing and meaning another thing. That's completely different. So just one other question before we break for the day. And tomorrow, I thought we were going to go a little quicker. Tomorrow we'll go through the steps of empathy. Today we talked about the blocks mainly, and tomorrow we're going to go through the steps, which you see here, observations. And you're welcome to read the book tonight to prepare yourself. The book has a lot of quotes from Prabhupada in it to substantiate what I'm saying. And so observations, observing something without judgment, being aware of our own feelings, this is our empathy for ourselves. And then connecting it to the needs and developing a strategy and maybe making requests or empathy for others. Once we've taken care of our own empathy, that was what the exercise was meant to show. You take care of your own self because your mind is disturbed, you're having unmet needs, it's going to be very hard to connect to other people. You know, when you're hungry, when you're tired. I mean, how many people when they're hungry, anybody here when you're hungry you get grouchy? Okay. Mayapur? Just wait till I get you later today. So, you know, so naturally we get a little grouchy. So it's hard to be empathic when you're grouchy. So anyway, so when you've taken care of your own needs, then you can observe things and talk to other people, help facilitate them in understanding their needs, and help to facilitate understanding strategies. This is the whole process right here, but it's all based on needs. So I think we have to, one question, yeah.
I was thinking about the exercise that you were doing, the last instance. So, empathy, like in the beginning, there was this kind of a definition that spoke about you try to understand the feelings of
others and of yourselves.
And of ourselves. So, does empathy also include that we are doing something for the feeling?
No.
Just understand.
Just being aware of them. We may do something or not do something.
Okay.
That's up to us.
So
we may not do anything or we may do something. That's all voluntary. But to connect with someone, to be aware, or to connect to ourselves, there's no action required. No.
That's also a choice.
That's a choice. Everything's a choice. We don't have to do anything. But, yeah, we can choose not to speak, or we can choose just to have our bodily actions or tone of voice or eyes, you know, the eyes of the mirror of the soul, connect to people. And when you're talking to people, it's good to look at their faces and connect with them. And you show your concern. That's empathy. There's no specific type of posture. I remember I went to one counseling class, and they told me when you counsel someone, you have to sit in a certain posture. You know, whatever. And it's not like that. It's a question of consciousness. You have the right consciousness, your posture will follow. And if you have even the right posture, your consciousness may be a million miles away. So counseling or empathy with people means just being connected, trying to understand their feelings and needs, trying to understand your own feelings and needs. That's empathy. And also, being vulnerable, being ready to tell others about you in the right situation. Being ready to explain to others about your own feelings and needs. Don't be diplomatic. Don't try to portray yourself as something that you're not. Don't have a facade. But just being open and honest. I mean, if we could do that in our Krishna conscious movement, it would be wonderful. Everybody could be open, honest, empathic. Be Vaikuntha. Okay, I think we have to end. All glories to His divine grace. Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.